The next case set for argument is State of South Dakota versus Troy O'Brien. We have John Heinrichs, who's appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. O'Brien, and Sarah Thorne, who's appearing, will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Mr. Heinrichs, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Heinrichs. I represent Troy O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien was found guilty of various criminal charges in a Lincoln County jury trial in 2022. Among those criminal charges were charges of rape in the second degree and rape in the fourth degree. Mr. O'Brien respectfully argues to the court that the convictions on those two counts should not stand on two grounds. The first ground being that there was insufficient evidence of penetration for a rational trier of fact to find beyond a reasonable doubt that penetration occurred, which of course is an essential element of both of the rape counts. The second count being that there was clear error in violation of his due process rights when the court neither gave a unanimity instruction to the jury and the state did not elect which of the various allegations of rape that they were relying upon for those two counts.
Counsel,
go ahead. As I understand on the second issue, the unanimity issue, you're only challenging the rape convictions.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because of the harmless error analysis that's part of the clear error analysis, we elected only to appeal the two rape convictions.
And when you go to that part of your argument, and I won't interrupt you further, but can you please address whether or not there's prejudice with reference to the unanimity instruction?
I'll be looking forward
to your answer on that.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you don't mind me beginning with issue one, thank you, Your Honor. The allegation in this case arose when the 16-year-old daughter of Mr. O'Brien's partner, non-spousal partner, made allegations of sexual abuse against Mr. O'Brien. They had resided together as a family unit for several years. Her allegations were very limited. RM, the minor in question, was the state's primary witness at trial, and she provided all of the direct evidence upon which the state relied in her testimony. Her testimony regarding what she referred to many times as touching, never going into more specific detail than that, was that he touched her, quote, where she goes pee, or that she touched her, quote, woman's part. There was no specific mention by any means of any specific anatomical area of her body upon which we respectfully argue the jury could assume that there was any intrusion, no matter how slight, even of RM's labia.
So one of the things that happened during the direct examination of the victim was this drawing, that she drew, and you know, she drew this little highlighted section, and was asked about that. That's pretty specific in terms of, I mean, it seems to be somewhat anatomically correct, and then a very specific right in the middle, kind of inside, that's where he was touching her. And so talk about that.
So the court's referring to demonstrative exhibit.
Yeah.
It was admitted as a demonstrative exhibit. It was a sketch that, according to the record, and I wasn't trial counsel, but as I understand the record, it was a sketch that RM apparently made on the stand. It cannot be divorced from her testimony. In and of itself, Exhibit 3, I would respectfully suggest to the court, lacks probative value in the absence of the context of her testimony. Her testimony was far more ambiguous. Her testimony was that he touched her where she goes pee. Her testimony regarding the part of the drawing was when the state was asking her questions, I think it's fair to infer, trying to get her to testify or describe her labia. She said, well, that's just where my woman parts meet my legs. Her testimony in and of itself was far too vague or ambiguous for a rational trier of fact to infer that she meant her labia and that there was an intrusion. She just simply said, woman's part where I go pee, which of course could be an age-appropriate reference to just the general pudendal area.
She said he molested me, or also known as raped me.
She did, and when she was asked about using those phrases, she made it very clear that those were phrases that she elected to use on her own, that nobody shared with her. She clearly didn't have any education into what those phrases meant, particularly rape. There's no reason to believe that she understood that a necessary element of rape was intrusion or penetration. She said that she was using those phrases in order to sound more professional in court. There was no additional direct examination. I think the only, frankly, reasonable inference is that was just colloquial on her part. Now, she did use words other than simply touch when she was describing other conduct by Mr. O'Brien. She was able to use the word rub when she was describing how Mr. O'Brien was touching her on her breasts and on her legs. The state tried to, through some very vigorous direct examination or attempt at direct examination, the state did try to get her to elaborate on what would happen when he reached between her legs. In that situation, she would just simply say that she had no recollection or that she didn't know. The state makes the argument, of course, that she was very nervous, and she fully admitted that she was nervous and that she suffered from anxiety, and there was testimony in that regard. However, we would respectfully suggest to the court that it's not reasonable to infer that RM meant something different than what she was testifying to simply because she may have been nervous when she was testifying. We can't look or try to fill in the gaps in her testimony or add to her testimony simply because she was nervous. She was very honest about how nervous she was, and it was apparent that she was trying to overcome that nervousness and testify truthfully and thoroughly. Despite that, she always used the word touch and never anything that implied something more than simply touching, nothing more that a rational trier of fact could infer meant penetration.
But the object of the verb touch, which may itself also be colloquial in some respects, was woman parts. At some point. So why couldn't a rational fact finder exercising common sense find the element of penetration, however slight, with terminology along those lines?
Because the terminology in and of itself, you can't exclude touching outside the pudendal area. You can't exclude touching above the area, around the area. Touch, woman's part, where I go pee, those are colloquialisms that are age-appropriate for the area outside her genitalia, on the exterior of the genitalia, not necessarily on the interior. Our argument would be that you need something more in order to infer something more. And we acknowledge that she does not have to use specific anatomical phrases, my Tabor's medical encyclopedia. She doesn't have to do that, but at a minimum, you have to be able to distinguish between touch on the exterior and the interior, and the record is absent of any evidence of that.
And I understand your argument in that regard. Could the jury consider, in addition to that evidence insofar as it goes, could it consider all the other evidence as well that she described about how these incidents occurred, where they occurred, the relative detail that she used to express them, their frequency? Could they pull that all together and say, you know, when we look at it all, we think that even though maybe it's not crystal clear or as precise as it could have been anatomically, we think that this was the purpose and this is circumstantially proven?
I think that would be engaging in speculation. I think that gets to the second issue regarding the unanimity instruction, which I'll move to next. But most importantly, While, of course, the jury has to consider all of the evidence and all of the testimony, I don't think that that means that the jury has to ignore when she's describing the specific conduct, yet cannot provide the words or does not provide the words that could lead them to infer that on this specific instance there was actually penetration. I think what the court is proposing is that perhaps a jury could say, well, it happened so many times, during one of those occasions there had to have been penetration. And I think that that is not only...
Well, not even so much a volume thing, but just that would explain why it was happening as she described it. So, in other words, the fact that it was happening when it was happening, as she described it happening, suggests that this was not, you know, touching that was more peripheral. That there was a more purposeful effort on the part of the defendant.
One problem with that supposition, I believe, Your Honor, would be that if you do that, you're almost writing the penetration element out of the statute, because you're saying if we can suggest to you that there is enough evidence here that he did these things, that if there's any touching in this kind of context, you should assume penetration. And I think that that would be a violation of his rights. With regard to the second issue regarding the unanimity instruction, RM testified under direct examination about multiple incidents of sexual touching by Mr. O'Brien. There was testimony from the Child's Voice interviewer, Ms. Crevier, who had interviewed RM, that said that her descriptions of those incidents during that Child's Voice interview were consistent. Specifically, RM was asked on direct examination about the most recent incident, which she said occurred in her mother and Mr. O'Brien's bedroom. She also testified that there was, it's not clear from the record, but there were at least two incidents in her bedroom and then some unknown number of incidents in the living room, as well as some incidents that apparently occurred at other addresses at dates outside the scope of the indictment. At no point did the state tell the jury, this is the incident that we're talking about, this is the incident, if you believe beyond a reasonable doubt it happened, you need to find him guilty. So the jury was relying on multiple incidents. There was no unanimity instruction. The defense attorney did not ask for a unanimity instruction, instructing the jury to all 12 people have to agree beyond a reasonable doubt on one incident and what actually occurred during that incident. So it is entirely possible that some jurors were relying in their verdict on the incident that was described in mother's bedroom, some on one or more of the incidents that were described in her bedroom.
Aside from a difference in location or perhaps time of when one of these incidents occurred, were there distinct differences in the description with regard to the rape charges, about the conduct that occurred in the different times or locations?
Most of the differences are peripheral. In some, she was already dressed. In some, he undressed her. In some incidents, he came and laid beside her. In some incidents, he pulled her over to him. So the peripheral conduct is different in different ones. Trial counsel did cross-examine Ms. Crevier, who did the forensic interview at Child's Voice, and elicited testimony that RM's disclosure of the incident in the bedroom differed from the testimony that she gave at trial regarding some of those facts. So there was also a credibility issue.
Facts with regard to the acts of the defendant, or again, these peripheral things?
Facts leading about the events that led up to the touching, who was there, who was in the bedroom first, who cuddled up again, who with whom. But they are credibility issues. And so they go to her credibility, which of course goes to all of her testimony, not just what she's talking about in that those specific details. So there was a credibility issue. It is entirely possible a jury could have listened to Ms. Crevier and RM and said that, she may not be credible, because she's told two different stories about this particular incident, so I'm going to rule that incident out and not consider it, or I'm not going to base a verdict on that particular incident. But we don't know, because there was not a unanimity instruction. So we don't know if any of the jurors disregarded that incident and were relying on one of the other ones.
Is that the extent of your prejudice argument? Do you have... How was your client prejudiced by the failure to give the unanimity instruction?
The failure to give the unanimity instruction, the first bit of prejudice is the fact that we don't know which of the incidents that RM described under direct testimony the jury was relying on, if they were relying on the ones in the house on John Street, or even if they were relying on some of the ones that would have occurred at a time outside the scope of the indictment that were referred to. The second one is we don't know if the jury took an opportunity to consider her credibility with regard to that first incident that is alleged to have occurred in her mother's room, where trial counsel elicited some testimony that there were differing versions of that event. I see my time has expired.
But let me just ask you one question before you step down. How is this any different than State versus Malm, where the court found no prejudice and talked about them being basically undifferentiated acts? We've got the RM saying here it happened the same way every time in terms of how the touching occurred. How is this any different from what the court in Malm described as undifferentiated, and there's really no prejudice because of that, because they all occurred the same way?
And I think I discussed this in a little more detail in my reply brief, but I do believe that they're differentiated in that there are variations as to how the contact was initiated, who initiated it, whether she was dressed or undressed when it began. And then, of course, there's the issue with the first incident about which she testified that's alleged to have occurred in her mother's room regarding what she told the jury at trial and what she apparently told Ms. Crevier when she had her forensic interview.
Thank you. Ms. Thorne, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court. Counsel, if it's fine with this court, I'll go ahead and pick up right where Mr. Henricks left off.
Asking about Malm. Are you conceding that plain error occurred here?
Not that there was plain error that justifies any amount of reversal on these counts.
No, I understand you don't concede prejudice, but in terms of the first two elements, that there was error and that it was plain and not giving, are you conceding those?
I believe we conceded that in our brief, yes, that the indictment was duplicitous and there was no election of specific acts tied to each count, and there was no modified unanimity instruction given.
So that would be the error. And then you're also conceding that under Mum, it was plain, which means the court should have done it on its own, and the law was so plain that the court was compelled to do it. That's two, prong two of plain error. You're conceding that one as well?
Correct, Your Honor. The state, I believe, in its brief and here again today, relies on the fact that this court can rest assured that any error in failing to require that election of acts or give the modified unanimity instruction was harmless and did not contribute to the verdict. None of O'Brien's constitutionally protected rights were violated because this case is like Mum. Picking up where Mr. Henricks left off, in his reply brief, he argued that the testimony here is not generic, as it was labeled in Mum, or a generic vague pattern of acts. And it's important to break down exactly what acts were referenced in Mum. In Mum, there were two victims and one male defendant. The evidence in that case involved touching penises, touching butts, rubbing butts, touching penises to butts, penises penetrating. The little children talked about having to jack off the defendant, that he jacked off the victims, that there was licking of chocolate syrup, the sucking and the rubbing and the lubricating, penetration every weekend for over the course mostly of 4 years. Here we have one victim, and I don't disagree that the peripheral conduct, as Mr. Henricks stated, was different, but the touching was the same every time. Her testimony aligned with that. The child's voice interviewer testimony aligned with that, and it was, for the most part, in every room of every home that they lived in from the time RM was in second grade through 10th grade. So if an election of acts weren't possible in MUM, it's certainly not possible here. There's no evidence and no likelihood that there was less than a unanimous jury determination when Mr. O'Brien went to trial on 9 counts and the jury returned 9 guilty verdicts. As this court stated in MUM, although the jury can't be or may not be able to readily distinguish between the various acts, it's certainly capable of unanimously agreeing that they took place in the number and the manner described. So really that comes down to, again, the credibility dispute. Issue 2 relies solely on whether the jury believed RM or not. Credibility was the true issue, and the jury certainly believed RM. As to issue 1, a rape victim's testimony alone is sufficient to prove the element of penetration. To carry its burden of proof on counts 1 and 2, the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was any intrusion, however slight, of any part of Mr. O'Brien's body into the genital openings of RM's body.
What's the strongest evidence in the record on that point?
Her testimony is enough. And this court has actually already handled this issue in Tui, which was based on testimony alone. In Tui, the victim there, KM, just like RM here, used only the word touched. KM, just like RM, said nothing about insertion or inside.
Tui discussed pain. The victim mentioned pain. And so what's the strongest testimonial evidence from the victim in this record with reference to penetration?
I think it's important to recall that in Tui, KM's words were that the touching was uncomfortable. RM here, also said uncomfortable or really uncomfortable. It was actually the forensic interviewer in Tui who asked questions of the victim in that case and asked if she experienced any pain after the touching. But irrespective of any degree of pain in that case versus this case, along with any suggestion that there need to be any additional corroborating evidence, such as an STD or an injury or some magic word that goes in between, you know, the realm of uncomfortable all the way up to extremely painful, all of that is a red herring. We need not prove penetration by any amount of medical evidence or any certain level of circumstantial evidence. There is no question that RM's testimony in this case wasn't filled with explicit definitions or explanations. As far as I'm aware, none of us in this courtroom today were in the courtroom that day to understand why the judge said it's clear that she's developmentally disabled, or to see RM shut down each time she was pressed with questions leading toward the topic of penetration.
But does that really matter on the sufficiency? In other words, she was a competent witness, so whether she had some frailties, that doesn't really matter on our sufficiency question, does it?
It certainly doesn't hinder the
state's. That seemed to be what the state's brief implied, in at least. Maybe I read too much into that.
And I would argue that it simply might explain why her drawing or her drawing said what her words could not say. She drew a relatively anatomically correct picture of her vagina. And the star that she placed where she was touched wasn't on top of those ovular lines. It was directly in the center of those. It was right and it was reasonable for the jury to use its common sense to conclude that O'Brien touched the very center of her vaginal genitalia, and that his fingers must have crossed the plane of the labia majora. But bringing this full center, the question for this court is not whether it would come to the same conclusion that the jury did here. Nor will this court reweigh the evidence or RM's credibility. This court simply has to ask itself whether any reasonable juror could have come to the same conclusion that they did, resolving all inferences in favor of the jury's verdict. The evidence showed that O'Brien's fingers went to RM's woman's part. causing RM discomfort, and that his fingers entered the very center of her vaginal genitalia, sufficiently proving penetration. Again, just like issue two, issue one comes down to whether the jury believed RM or not, and the jury believed her.
As it relates to issue two, and I know that we've talked about plain error, plain, it was error and it was plain. And my first inclination or my thought was, well, is there some indication in the record that Mr. O'Brien suggested he didn't have enough information about what he was facing in order to defend? And, you know, that may be not as important if we're past prong one and two, but still, in closing argument, I've got it up and I'm trying to reflect on it, but perhaps you could help me. Is there some sense in closing argument or some sense along the way that Mr. O'Brien felt he was at a disadvantage because he didn't know what he was facing, what among these allegations was really in play, anything like that?
There was nothing like that, and that disposes of any argument that there was a violation of his due process right to present a defense. Had there been any sort of suggestion that the indictment failed to allege any specific dates, or had he ever raised some sort of alibi defense, that might be a factor.
Or even in closing argument, look, it's almost impossible for you to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt because it's so imprecise, it's so vague. We don't even really know what it's, you know, zeroing in on. Anything like that?
Nothing like that. And even had there been, that argument was disposed of in Basker and then again reaffirmed in Mum. In the same vein, no double jeopardy violation because there were enough acts to cover each count.
That hasn't been argued, has it? I don't think
it hasn't been argued.
I think defendant's only argument relates to that unanimity instruction. And exactly. I guess Mr. Heinrichs can tell us if it's other than that, but that's my understanding.
Correct, Your Honor. As I stated before, there's no question that RM's testimony wasn't as thorough or as fluid as it would have been scripted. I think that anyone who's ever tried a case expects that. Emotions are high, responses are subjective, even vocabulary differs. And reasonable inferences of those in the courtroom that day may have been that RM simply didn't have the words. And it's not that she didn't say much, but she didn't articulate the words in the way the defendant, or frankly even the state, would have wanted her to. I think, as Mr. Henry suggested, that was clear based on the transcript. So instead she drew her picture, and her drawing said what she couldn't say. And I think it's clear that the jury believed her. We don't get to reweigh her credibility. We don't get to see the reason why the judge said what he did. We don't get to see the way that she curled within herself when pressed with questions about penetration. And we don't have to. We don't have to do any amount of speculation in this case. We really only need to look at RM's words and her drawing. And this court, again, need only decide whether any rational juror could have come to the conclusion that they did. What she stated and what she drew was enough. And because the jury believed RM, O'Brien was not prejudiced for any lack of unanimity in the indictment as well.
I want to follow up with you on that and tie in Mullen again to that. Mullen, there was more direct testimony about penetration in that case where there was penetration occurring. I think there was actual testimony of that. We don't hear it's circumstantial. So this would appear to be a thinner case as far as sufficiency of the evidence. Does that matter as we look at prejudice? In other words, we're asking the jury, all 12 of you, did you agree on this? In Mulm, we had actual testimony of there was penetration. We don't have that here. Does that matter as we think about prejudice in the second issue?
It does not matter. There's no magical level that a victim must reach in order to, allow her testimony to be deemed credible enough. As long as this court upholds counts one and two, deeming that there was sufficient evidence.
But does it create more question in terms of did all 12 of those jurors believe that penetration had occurred on each of those occasions on the question of unanimity?
You know, had there been any amount of division as to the jury's holding on any of the counts. That might be an argument. But as I stated here, it's very clear based on the jury's verdicts that they believed RM, and they believed that every event that, or every act that she testified to, in fact, occurred. If there are no other questions, the state asks that this court affirm convictions on counts 1 and 2. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heinrichs, you can proceed with rebuttal.
I'd like to begin, if I may, by returning to the second issue regarding the unanimity instruction or failure to elect a charge. We would respectfully disagree with the state that it was not possible for the state to elect a specific incident in this case, just as it was not possible for them to in Mum. I think the record is very clear that RM was able to describe with specificity the location, the timing, not only the location in terms of what street the abuse occurred on, but what room in the house the abuse occurred on.
But is that really the test? Does the state need that to win? Is that necessary for affirmance that there was this impossible task of defining with particularity what events or that or when they occurred? Or is it really just accepting the idea that, hey, none of this was instructed? It's less about whether they could have done it, whether it would have been possible in the moment, and now more of assessing whether it was absolutely necessary in order to recognize and vindicate your client's rights.
I
understand that was the argument, but is that even necessary? Is it really a question of impossibility in the moment, or really assessing this case in light of what happened?
Well, I think you have to assess it in light of what happened, because the jury did find Mr. O'Brien guilty based upon at least testimony about at least five different incidents. And so,
in the closing argument, though, it doesn't seem like counsel really perceived that there was, you know, big differences. In fact, one of the themes running through the closing argument is that there's just not much detail. And it almost seemed like the closing argument treated the offenses rather generically, rather generally. Wouldn't that tend to support the state's argument?
No, I don't think so, because he did refer to the credibility issue. He did talk in his closing argument, as I recall, about the fact that there were apparent variations between her story to Child's voice and her testimony at the trial itself with regard to at least one incident. And I'm not in a position now to be critical or subjective about what trial counsel's closing argument was. But I think that he raised the issue enough. He talked about there are these different incidents. We don't know when they occurred or where they occurred. They lived on different streets. I think a logical follow-up, though, to that issue that Your Honor raises is that, you know, one of the purposes of the unanimity instruction or the election of a charge is so that the defendant can be confident that the jury has found beyond a reasonable doubt that they're guilty of a specific incident. When you have these descriptions of various incidents which match in some degree, the defendant cannot be confident that the jury didn't say, well, we're going to find him guilty because it happened so many times. It's alleged so many times it must have happened at least once. And that's I believe that that's a real danger that is remedied by the giving of the unanimity instruction or a clear and explicit election by the state when it comes to selecting charges. The other thing that I would point out about the failure to elect a charge or a unanimity instruction is with regard to Exhibit 3, which was a very important part of the state's case and which we talked about earlier, we don't know which incident RM described corresponds to Exhibit 3 in her testimony. She was just given and she was told to draw a picture, but we don't know if when she put a star on that area of the picture, which of the incidents she was talking about.
But Exhibit 3. Does that matter if when she said they asked her, you know, was the touching different on any occasion? She said they were exact. I think her words were the exact same.
I think it does when she gets so specific as to try to point out where the touching occurred. I think when you're getting that specific, that the burden should be on the state to say, well, when did this occur? When did he touch you in that location? And again, I'm not conceding that when she put that star on there that she was referring specifically to her urethral opening and not just to the general vaginal area. But even if that was in fact what she intended but didn't have the words to say it, I think that they have to say which incident was this or which of these incidents were this. My time is running out, so I just want to close by addressing one of the state's arguments, which was discussed about her not having the words, and so the jury could still infer. No, her not having the words, as sympathetic as I am to her for not, apparently not having the words, the jury can't fill it in for her. The jury can't finish the state's story for her. It's still the state's burden. Her being nervous, being a youth, not having the words, does not absolve the state of their burden. We'd respectfully ask you to reverse the conviction on those two counts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.